Mens rea, the guilty mind. It's the intent needed to prove certain crimes, such as murder. Join me, your host Sinead, as I explore the stories of missing women, abusive husbands, jealous brothers, and the silence of the Irish countryside. Then follow these stories to the historic buildings of the UK and Ireland for the legal argument to prove guilt. Mens Rea releases new episodes every second Sunday, so for true crime from the Emerald Isle, join me. And until then, don't do anything I wouldn't do.
You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Thank you for choosing our podcast. Our sponsors make it possible for us to keep bringing you new episodes. Please support them as they have some great deals just for you, our listeners. If you prefer to listen to ad-free content, simply find us on Patreon, where plans start from as little as $2 a month. 25% of these proceeds are donated to the Doe Network, working to bring closure to international cold cases. For more information, follow the link in the show notes.
Evidence Locker is sponsored by BetterHelp, the world's largest online counseling platform. Take charge of your mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Go to betterhelp.com/evidence today and get 10% off your first month.
Our cases deal with true crimes and real people. Some parts are graphic in nature, and listener discretion is advised. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. Warning. This episode contains details of demonic possession and the mutilation of an animal and may not be suitable for all listeners. It was a Sunday morning like any other in Ossett, West Yorkshire, on the 6th of October, 1974. People from the quiet family-friendly neighborhood of Havercroft were making their way to church, and only a handful of shops were open. It was unusual for police to receive a call of public disturbance on a Sunday morning, and they assumed the man causing people to call in was perhaps a student from the nearby Leeds University, coming down from an acid trip, perhaps. When they arrived at the scene, they saw 31-year-old Michael Taylor slumped on a sidewalk outside of a pub. He was naked, except for socks on his feet, and was curled up in the fetal position, covered in blood. It looked like he was drunk, but on closer inspection, it was clear that the man was seriously disturbed. When the ambulance took him away, he kept screaming about the devil, shouting, "It is the blood of Satan! It is the blood of Satan! It is the blood of Satan!" But this was not true. The blood on his hands came from his beloved wife and their family dog. Michael was known in his community as a mild-mannered and God-fearing person. What went so horribly wrong that he killed his wife on this Sunday morning? The early 1970s were years of political uncertainty. The Cold War was raging on and people in England were nervously aware of the troubles in neighboring Ireland. Unemployment was on the rise, and so was inflation. There was a general sense of hopelessness. It has been said that this was a time of extremes in England. People clung to ideas and beliefs to foster a sense of hope. After a decade of counterculture, baby boomers were more open-minded and had the need for less traditional religious practice. Where some explored New Age spiritualism or even the occult, others preferred charismatic Christianity. To contextualize, the release of cult classic The Wicker Man, with strong suggestions of paganism, was released in 1973. And being a time of extremes for every group, idea, or practice, there was the polar opposite. There was also the rise of satanic panic, after the 1972 release of American evangelist Mark Warnke's book, The Satan Seller, made waves in the Christian community. In 1974, Ossett, West Yorkshire, was home to 17,000 residents. It was a quiet place with many traditional churches. But like many small towns in England in the early 70s, charismatic worship was rapidly gaining popularity. 31-year-old Michael Taylor and his 29-year-old wife Christine was perhaps a typical couple of the time. They had 5 sons between the ages of 6 and 12. They had a loving home, and Michael called Christine his darling wife. Everyone who knew them envied their happy marriage. They lived in the same neighborhood as Michael's parents, and as Michael's father later said about his son and daughter-in-law, they were still courting throughout their marriage. The Taylor home was busy and loud with lots of laughter. Christine doted on her dog, a poodle, and Michael always joked that she loved the dog more than she loved him. Michael was mild-mannered, and Christine was sweet. Michael was a manual laborer. Some sources say he was a butcher, others that he had worked as an agricultural machine operator. Either way, a back injury at the beginning of 1974 prevented him from working long physical hours. He struggled to find another job, and the Taylors, who had been living comfortably up till that point in time, began to struggle financially. Because of this, he fell into a depression. They had not been very religious before. Most of us, it was traditionally religious and people attended church often, but with the increase in charismatic worship, they were one of many young couples who realigned their beliefs and decided to join the Gobber Christian Fellowship Group. It was Barbara Wardman, a friend and neighbor of Michael and Christine's, who took it upon herself to introduce them to the progressive religious group. Barbara told her friends that this church, which was a part of the St. Thomas Church in Gobber, was anything but a stuck-up or traditional place of worship. It was a group of like-minded Christians, and as a group, it offered friendship and support. Nothing seemed untoward, and the Taylors agreed to attend a Bible study group with Barbara to check it out. And that was all it took. The Taylors only needed one visit to be convinced that this was where they wanted to be. The group had a down-to-earth approach, which gave them a sense of belonging. The Christian Fellowship Group was a charismatic church who steered away from traditional English church philosophy. They believed in faith healing and spirituality. Modern music was used in worship, and sermons were very emotional. At a time when the world seemed to be in a tug-of-war between capitalism and communism, everyday people just wanted to get on with it. Churches like the Christian Fellowship offered them a place to be heard, to feel valued, and to hope for a brighter future together. To join the church in question, one would have to be a born-again Christian. The Taylors agreed that this was necessary, so they converted and from the get-go became active members of the congregation. It was at church where the Taylors met a lay preacher by the name of Marie Robinson. Michael, in particular, grew very close to Marie, quite quickly. She encouraged him to become involved in the church, and before long, Michael volunteered at group meetings, enthusiastically engaging in all activities. He also spoke in tongues and hosted many meetings and Bible study groups at his home. Christine grew concerned about Michael and Marie's close relationship and expressed it to a Bible study group at their home, saying that she believed their relationship had turned carnal in nature. She confronted her husband and the preacher in front of everybody and demanded to know if they were having an affair. They denied it, and the group suggested Michael and Marie talk things out in private. Strange, perhaps, that they didn't suggest Michael and his wife talk things over, but rather him and the woman he was suspected of having an affair with. Maybe everyone could sense the tension between the two and wanted to give them a moment to end things. Reportedly, Michael took Marie upstairs, and instead of setting things straight, he opened up about his feelings for her and tried to kiss her. She was not interested and rejected his advances. Embarrassed, but quickly bouncing back, Michael declared the situation as a victory for the Lord. He ran downstairs and told the group that thanks to the Lord, their lingering feelings for each other had evaporated. It was all over. He said, "A miracle has happened. We have both overcome our passions." Marie was relieved that he took it so well. But suddenly, his attitude changed. She would recall it to have been a sinister transformation, like something had entered his body before he proceeded to hit her. This is Marie's account of the incident. "I suddenly glanced at Mike and his whole features changed. He looked almost bestial. He kept looking at me and there was really a wild look in his eyes. I started screaming at him out of fear. I started speaking in tongues. Mike also screamed at me in tongues." Michael later claimed that he could not remember anything regarding the attack. He only said he felt an evil force taking over, and he recalled. She stabbed me with her eyes. I can still see those eyes. I saw her standing naked before me, and I was naked. And then Marie's account explained what happened next. She said he attacked her, screaming at her in tongues. Christine tried to pull him off me. Somehow, we were at the other side of the room, away from her, with him crouching over me, ready to kill. It was like pictures of lions ready to kill their prey. I really tasted fear in my mouth. I thought this was it. I was on the verge of death and I seemed to come to my senses. I knew that Jesus would save me and I started saying his name over and over. When Christine heard me calling on the name of Jesus, she started saying it too, and I believed firmly that it was only by calling on his name that I was not killed. The next day, Marie visited the Taylors at home, but Christine did not want to let her inside. She felt it would be better to keep Michael and the preacher apart. However, Marie insisted and said that she had come to tell Michael all was forgiven. Christine relented and they had a short visit, during which Marie cleared the air between her and Michael and also brought news that the church would not hold the event against him. All was forgiven and they could go on as per usual, but Christine had her doubts about it all. If only she listened to her instincts at this point. But then again, there was no way of knowing that 2 weeks later, she would be dead. After the violent incident with Marie, Michael's behavior became increasingly erratic. He had turned his anger toward all things religious and destroyed all Bibles and religious books in his house. The once kind and gentle man had become easily annoyed, especially by his wife and children. He knelt in the street outside of his house, shouting. He told neighbors he had seen the devil. His mental health deteriorated, and he developed a paralyzing fear of the moon, something Marie tried to help him with but failed. The church leaders saw Michael's behavior as a red flag. They believed that he had become possessed by the devil. The only way forward was to perform an exorcism. A meeting was arranged with a local Anglican priest in charge, 52-year-old Peter Vincent from St. Thomas Gabber, the same church that hosted the Christian Fellowship Group. Father Vincent had experience in exorcisms and agreed to meet with Michael. When he asked Michael why he had attacked Marie Robinson, a bruised and embarrassed Michael claimed that she had tried to seduce him in front of his wife. He also believed that she had bewitched him somehow, causing him to become fully possessed. Both Peter and his wife Sally sympathized with Michael. In fact, Sally especially agreed that Marie was most likely the cause of the possession. She had become suspicious of the beautiful young blonde preacher and was concerned about her effect on the men in the congregation. Father Vincent agreed with concerned group leaders that Michael was indeed the victim of demonic possession, and his was a very serious case. It is believed that the clergyman's wife, Sally, was obsessed with demonic possession, and it was her who pushed for an exorcism. She stoked the fires regarding Marie Robinson, and felt that she was connected with a satanic cult, and had come to their congregation as a wolf in sheep's clothing. However, Christine Taylor was not so sure about the exorcism. She felt that all Michael needed was a break from the church and from religion. She was confident that by spending time with her and their children, he would calm down again. She visited her neighbor Barbara, the one who had introduced them to the fellowship, on the 4th of October. Barbara claimed that Christine looked drained. The situation had taken its toll on her. She told Barbara that they no longer wished to be a part of the fellowship and gave her a heads up that they wouldn't be attending meetings any longer. Barbara recalled Christine's answer when she asked if she was okay. Chrissy told me they had been up all night. As soon as it began to get dark and the moon was up, Michael started to go on about the moon. They sat downstairs in the sitting room all night making the sign of the cross over each other to keep each other safe. Let's consider the effect of the full moon on people for a minute. Now, many call this speculation or mumbo jumbo, but studies have been conducted showing an increase in crime rates on nights where full moons are present. Although it's not quite clear why, it is so common that some police stations and hospitals schedule extra officers for full moon nights. Even William Shakespeare mentioned the effect of the moon in Othello. It is the very error of the moon. She comes more near the earth than she was wont, and makes men mad. The very word lunacy is derived from the Latin word for moon, so it is possible that there is something to it. Could the full moon drive one to insanity? Many people believe it is all a myth, and that bizarre episodes occur only because people expect things to go awry when the moon is full. Full moon fever. Despite what one believes, the fact remains that Michael Taylor was heavily affected by the moon, whether by his own perception or otherwise. In astrology, the month of October is known for its harvest moon, or hunter's moon. In 1974, October kicked off with a full moon, and if Michael Taylor was as sensitive to the moon's testimonies say, it would have been a rough week with little sleep. A study conducted in 2014 at the University of Bonn, Germany, observed the effects of sleep deprivation in healthy patients between the ages of 18 and 40. After only 24 hours of no sleep, the subjects displayed concerning signs. The conclusion of the study, as stated on ScienceDaily.com, is 24 hours of sleep deprivation can lead to conditions in healthy persons similar to the symptoms of schizophrenia. A neighbor reported that Michael Taylor was out in the street again. This time, he was shouting at her to drink the milk of human kindness. Then he spat on her and told her it was milk. Taken aback at his behavior, the woman was keen to get away, and he shouted at her, pointing with his finger. The wrath of God is upon you. He was clearly already unhinged on that day, which was Thursday, the 3rd of October. Michael did not sleep that night, as Christine told her neighbor Barbara the next day. We're not sure if he caught any shut-eye on the Friday, but he certainly did not sleep at all the night that followed. Michael and Christine were summoned to the vicarage at St. Thomas Church on Saturday night, October 5th. They were reluctant at first, but after many sleepless nights, their defenses were low, and they agreed. They left their children with Michael's parents, and a friend drove them to the vicarage. Once they arrived, they were introduced to a team of religious leaders that had come to assist in the exorcism. Father Peter Vincent explained that he would take the lead, and would be supported by his wife Sally, as well as Methodist minister Reverend Raymond Smith and his wife Peggy. A lay preacher, Donald James, was also present. During the pre-exorcism meeting, Michael became agitated, throwing his tea in Father Vincent's face, and even kicking the clergyman's cat. St. Thomas was built in 1848, in the Gothic revivalist style of the time. The stone building had stained glass windows with pointed arches. On a chilly autumn night, it must have been an eerie, scary place to visit. Christine was kept under guard in the vicarage, where some church members remained with her, praying and laying hands on her, a sort of exorcism by proxy, if you will. Father Vincent and the deliverance squad moved Michael to the vestry just before midnight, waiting for the witching hour to commence the exorcism. Traditionally, an exorcism is a time-trusted ritual performed by a priest wearing his surplice and purple stole. He would recite prayers, commencing with the imploring formula, during which he appeals to God to free the possessed person from the devil. Then with the imperative formula, the priest commands the devil to depart from the host's body. The prayer is as follows. God, whose nature is ever merciful and forgiving, accept our prayer that this servant of yours, bound by the fetters of sin, may be pardoned by your loving kindness. Depart then, impious one, depart, accursed one, depart with all your deceits, for God has willed that man should be his temple. Typically, a priest would sprinkle holy water or make the sign of the cross on himself as well as on the possessed. The process is a battle of good versus evil, forcing the devil out in the name of God. But in the case of Michael Taylor, he was tied up before proceedings kicked off. According to everyone present, Michael displayed signs of possession. He convulsed, spat, foamed at the mouth, growled, and scratched like an animal. And that's why he had to be restrained. Michael wore a wooden crucifix around his neck, which was set on fire by the team of self-appointed exorcists. They screamed at him, or as they would claim, at the demons inside of him. The group doused him in holy water, and wooden crosses were shoved into his mouth. They forced him to confess his sins and accused him of sins he had not committed. And as was later stated by defense attorney Harry Ognall QC, Michael was subjected to indignities that defy comprehension. At one point, he managed to get out of his restraints and tried to escape, but the group caught him and restrained him again. In the end, they took turns exorcising one demon out after the next, listing them as they progressed. Bestiality, incest, blasphemy, and lewdness, masochism. This continued throughout the night, and believing that they had cast out over 40 demons in total, they were too exhausted to continue. It had been an emotionally charged night, and they decided that it was time to take a break, and Michael was untied and allowed to go home. They did, however, believe that three demons were still residing within Michael, but agreed that they would fight that battle at a later stage. which would prove to be a grave mistake. The demons who lingered were associated with murder, violence, and insanity. According to reports, Peggy Smith insisted they continue, because God had communicated to her that those demons would cause him to kill his wife. But everyone was spent, too tired to continue, and decided to call it a day. However, Michael was in a very bad way, and Peter Vincent took the drastic step of calling the police. The officer advised him to take Michael to the hospital, or at the very least, a doctor. Christine did not want to see a doctor. She just wanted to go home with her husband, away from the fellowship, and all the role players who were involved in the exorcism. They handed Michael over into Christine's care and sent the couple home. Christine, who had also been up all night, with women from the fellowship praying with her, for her and for Michael all night long, called a family friend to drive her and Michael home. Father Vincent later claimed that he was concerned about Christine's safety and thought that someone should have gone home with the Taylors to protect her. But in the chaos of the moment, he didn't follow through on the advice. It was 10 a.m. on the morning of October 6, 1974, when a concerned resident informed police that a naked man covered in red paint was wandering the streets. Police officers located said man. It was Michael Taylor, and he was not covered in paint. It was blood. No injuries were found on Michael's body that could explain all the blood. But he told the police officer, "They primed me for it last night. They tried to bring me peace of mind, but instead they filled me with the devil. It was within her. Oh God, it used her. It used my love. I destroyed the evil within her. It had to be done. Oh hell, I love that woman. No, please God, no, please God." When asked if he had hurt someone, and if the blood on him was that person's blood, Michael responded by saying, "It's the blood of Satan. It's the blood of Satan." He repeated this over and over as the ambulance took him away, not offering any further explanation. Officers went to Michael's house and found another police vehicle parked out front and connected the dots. The scene at the Taylor house would haunt investigators for many years to come. An act of unimaginable violence had taken place inside the usually harmonious family home. Some officers came out heaving and vomiting. Police Constable Ian Walker, who was one of the first officers at the scene, recalled his superior coming out of the house retching, saying, "You don't want to see this one, son. I've seen nothing like it before, and I've seen a few. It's the wife. She's got no... He's ripped at her, son. It's a right mess in there. There's not much of her left. You don't want to see it, eh?" Flesh and blood covered the walls, the floor, the furniture. It seemed like the entire house was covered in blood. Christine's body was found in the living room, next to the mutilated body of their family dog. Christine's face had been torn off, and her eyes gouged out. Her tongue had been ripped out of her mouth and discarded. Christine's poodle also had his face ripped off, eyes gouged out, legs pulled out of their sockets, hair, teeth, and eyes all removed from his skull. PC Walker also recalled, "Of all the incidents in which I was involved in 30 years of police work, nothing affected me like this one. The stupidity and futility of it all, the complete and utter waste of life, destruction of a family, not to mention the death and other traumas are far beyond anything else I have ever come across. Before this event, I was agnostic. And now, I was an atheist." Fortunately, all of the Taylor children had spent the night at their grandparents' house, so they did not witness the heinous killing of their mother and dog. Police were unable to find a murder weapon, and soon understood why they couldn't find it. There was no weapon. The killer just used his bare hands. An autopsy concluded that Christine had died due to asphyxiation, inhaling her own blood. Brutal and painful as it must have been, her death is believed to have been quick. Michael Taylor was arrested at the hospital and taken in for questioning. He told his interrogating officers a chilling story of an exorcism performed on him before the murders. "Oh, it was a long night. They danced around me and burned my cross because that was tainted with the evil. They had me in the church all night. Look at my hands. I was banging on the floor. The power was in me. I couldn't get rid of it, and neither could they. They were too late. I was compelled by a force within me to destroy everything living within the house." Investigators asked how he felt after succeeding in the destruction of all living things inside his house, to which Michael answered, "Released. I am released. It's done. The evil in her has been destroyed." While on remand, Michael spent most of his time sleeping. It was like he did not want to be awake to face the truth. Because of the gruesome nature of the case, it was not reported on in the media until it came before the courts. The story of a man seeking help from church, then ending up ripping his wife's face off because of the priest's intervention, it would have caused massive unease within the community. Michael Taylor's trial took place at the Leeds Crown Court in March 1974. His defense stated that after the long and exhausting exorcism, he arrived home with his wife and somehow became convinced that she was possessed by Satan. A clinical psychologist testified for the defense, stating that Taylor's actions that morning were a direct result of the trauma he had suffered during the night before. And with pre-existing mental health issues, it was the exorcism that had flipped the switch. His lawyer, Harry Ognall QC, stated that misguided churchmen needed to be held responsible for their actions. His take on the situation was that it was a neurotics feeding neurosis to a neurotic. Anglican Bishop Right Reverend Eric Treacy distanced himself from the event, stating that no clergyman in the Diocese of Wakefield has my specific authority to practice exorcism, but I am aware that some clergymen will feel that it is a normal part of their pastoral ministry when occasion demands. Crown Prosecutor Jeffrey Baker stated that Christine's murder was the tragic end to a story of a sensible family man who was suddenly exposed to intense spiritual influences and became either bewitched or demented. They could never establish a motive for the murder, because by all accounts, Michael loved his wife, and had he been in full possession of his faculties, there was no way he would have harmed her, let alone committing such a cruel, bestial murder, killing her with his bare hands. In the end, Michael Taylor was found not guilty by reason of insanity and sent to Broadmoor's mental hospital, where he spent 2 years before being moved to a secure unit at the Bradford Royal Infirmary. There, he spent another 2 years before being released. After the trial, Harry Ognall called for the ones who had conducted the exorcism to be held accountable, saying, "I am aware that it is generally regarded as improper for an advocate to express any personal feeling or opinion about the case in which he is engaged. I am afraid. I find it quite impossible to observe such constraints in this case. Let those who are truly responsible for this killing stand up. We submit that Taylor is a mere cipher. The real guilt lies elsewhere. Religion is the key. Those who have been referred to in evidence, and those clerics in particular, should be with him in spirit now, in this building, and each day he is incarcerated in Broadmoor, and not least on the day he must endure the bitter reunion with his 5 motherless children." During his trial, evidence about an affair with Marie Robinson was presented. She denied that they ever had a romantic relationship, but the trial cast a shadow of doubt. Furthermore, an inquest was ordered to investigate the events that took place during the exorcism in St. Thomas Church the night before the murder. The Anglican Church thus launched the inquest into what they called the Satan killing. Peter Vincent has never shown any remorse for his role in Christine Taylor's murder, insisting that Michael Taylor had truly been possessed and that they had only tried to help him. Vincent's career continued to thrive, and only a year after the exorcism of Michael Taylor, he became a vicar at the Gobber Fellowship. The media was not kind to the man who had taken a mother and father away from 5 children. When asked how he felt about it all, Reverend Vincent simply answered, "God will bring good out of this in his own way." According to Reverend Raymond Smith, he was at Reverend Vincent's house on the day the Taylors visited him for the first time. He was very concerned about Michael and had taken Christine aside, discreetly suggesting they sought medical or psychological advice. But Christine refused, believing that it would only cause more stress and make things worse. Reverend Smith was perhaps more remorseful than Reverend Vincent, and stated after the trial, "If people come to me in trouble of any kind, I would try to help. I would give such comfort as I could, but I am only an ordinary human being with human failings." The church concluded that nothing was done wrong in commission of the exorcism. The only failure was not driving all of the demons out. The trial sparked controversy, making people ask why the ancient ritual of exorcism was still practiced at all. None of the church members present at the exorcism were ever charged with any wrongdoings on their part, and Michael Taylor never spent a day in prison for the brutal murder of his wife. After his release from Bradford Royal Infirmary, Michael moved back to Ossett, There is little information about his life after his release, and we do not know if he reconciled with his children. In the years after Christine's death, however, Michael was reported to have attempted suicide on 4 separate occasions, slitting his wrists and jumping off a bridge on another occasion, seriously injuring his legs and back. In 2005, Michael Taylor made the headlines again, this time for indecently touching a teenage girl. He was found guilty, and once in prison began to display the same strange behavior he did back in 1974. The court ruled that he needed to receive psychiatric treatment, and again, he left prison for the psych ward. Michael's case is often mentioned alongside the 1981 case of an American man, Arn Johnson, who killed his landlord, claiming that he had been possessed by the devil. Both murders have been labeled as the Devil Made Me Do It cases. The 2021 horror film The Conjuring 3, The Devil Made Me Do It, was inspired by events surrounding both Michael Taylor as well as Arn Johnson. Question is, did Michael and Arn really believe it was the devil who made them do it? The judicial system is wary of such an explanation, because if they believed it, every criminal could simply turn around and blame the devil.
We'd like to thank today's sponsors, BetterHelp. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit BetterHelp.com/evidence today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/evidence.
If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit us on social media to see more about today's case. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also check out our channel on YouTube. If you like what we do here at Evidence Locker, subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you are listening right now, and kindly leave a 5-star review. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.